Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Scott Santon's UBI Enterprise. This time is going to be part three of Teresa Funicello's Tyranny of Kindness. So if you haven't listened to the previous two parts, I definitely suggest listening to those first or definitely after this. If you listen to all three, then it's still not the entire book, but really you'll have your bases covered for most of the book, so you can almost kind of think of it as a Cliff's Notes version or just a shorter version in general. But this is all Tyranny of Kindness, and this third part is pretty much mostly about, actually, guaranteed income. And so the history of basic income, as it was called, guaranteed income, back in the 70s, and where kind of that discussion came from, the experiments into it, what we learned. So there's really a lot of interesting stuff in this episode, particularly and specifically about basic income, instead of the previous two parts that were more about why basic income makes sense as an understanding of just how deficient and hole-filled and problematic the conditional safety net is. So, please listen to this and enjoy. And again, I urge everyone to get a hold of a copy of Tyranny of Kindness and just read through the whole book. It really is one of my favorite books that gets into just how important basic income is. And if you read it, then if you don't think basic income is a good idea, I think it'll change your mind, and if you already thought basic income was a good idea, you'll come out of it thinking it really is an extremely important idea, more so than you ever thought. So thank you for listening to this, and enjoy. Tyranny of Kindness, Part 3, Toward a Politics of Justice, Guaranteed Income. In the presidential election of 1992, change won in a landslide. Between the electorate who voiced their opinion in the voting booth and discouraged citizens who voiced theirs by not voting, there was an overwhelming mandate to redraw the political, social, and economic map of this country. We may be entering a period of social opportunity during which a new debate on a range of issues, including poverty, can and should take place. For decades, social policy has been made in the dark. It's time to turn on the lights so we can see the problem for what it is. Solutions will follow. Mother-only families who were poor increased from approximately 2.5 million in 1979 to 3.5 million in 1989. More than half of all children in single female households were poor. The poverty rate of children whose mothers have completed some college, including those with degrees, is almost 1 out of 3, nearly the same rate as that of two-parent families in which the father has not even completed high school. In other words, more education, per se, is no panacea, certainly not for mothers. Almost 2/3 of children in either African-American or Latina mother-only families are poor. Slightly less than half of white children of single mothers are poor. Although there has been some increase in the number and rate of male-only households with children, those remain exceptions and generally are not poor relative to the total poverty population. Of all single-parent families, female households constitute 94% of those in poverty. The poverty rate for mother-only families is 3 times that of father-only families. The majority of poor mother-only families receive some amount of welfare for some period of time. The majority of poor mother-only families also have wage income for some period. Over the last decade, single mothers have increased their rate of paid employment. Still, their poverty rates have gone up. Physically challenged family heads also tend to have much higher poverty rates than other family heads. When they are women, they are twice as likely to be poor as their male counterparts. No matter how the numbers are cut, the problem is poverty, and the gender is largely female. Poverty gnaws at the body and spirit, both of individuals and of nations. No mother should have to ride the subways or set up house in an elevator shaft or an empty barn in lieu of putting her children to sleep in a warm bed at night. No one's children should die because her only source of heat, her kitchen stove, explodes. No one who has not broken any laws or in any way neglected her children by any standard definition should be forced into counseling as a precondition for obtaining shelter. No one should be presumed to be less than human simply because she is poor, particularly not women raising children under our system of welfare, a feat whose difficulty is not to be underestimated. My own experience was terrible. The experience of millions of other poor mothers and their children are unspeakable. None of these women or their children should ever be told that she is lazy, needs a job, and refuses to work. What they need is income. What the country needs is a healthy dose of reality, grounding unfettered by the good intentions of those who profit by degrading and infantilizing poor mothers. As we barrel into the 21st century, we are holding on tenaciously to 19th century notions of poor people and the policies that should govern them. There are many reasons that people are or become poor. One thing is certain: nobody chooses poverty. As a country, we have no excuse. Many other nations distribute resources far more equitably to those in and out of the wage labor force than the United States. Bad as it is, welfare, cash assistance, has been the lifeblood of millions who defy the odds by making a difficult but successful transition into the mainstream. Still, it is inexcusable that the obstacles are so many, the barriers so dense, and the public will so profoundly sterile that only the strongest, the toughest, the smartest, the most talented, the luckiest, the best educated have any real opportunity to advance. Advancing means leaving poverty or near poverty, not simply getting a poorly paying job. It is indefensible that our backup systems for simple subsistence are meted out most harshly and disproportionately to people of color and female households of all races. All this in what is arguably the wealthiest nation in history. It is estimated that one out of every three children in the United States will experience welfare for at least some part of his or her youth by the turn of the century. One out of every two in New York City. These children are all our children. They are also the future of the nation. Welfare, as we know it, cannot be fixed. Tinkering with it for decades has accomplished little of value. Bureaucracies within bureaucracies have bloomed, mutations of a polluted society. Too many contradictory interests compete at the public trough in the name of poor people. Entrenched charities dwarf any efforts at self-determination and actively muzzle the political expression of the people they purport to represent. Poor people of our inner cities, small towns, and rural countryside exist in a sprawling banana republic where fighting factions of outsiders, institutionalized poverty pimps, battle over which issue, which treatment, what cabal will dominate at any given point in time. Those who live in poverty are the means for the charities to acquire foreign aid from dozens of sources, including the U.S. government. A major impediment to dismantling the existing social welfare programs is the extent to which they have degenerated into patronage troughs. The government contracts to help are first and foremost political tools to strengthen the base of elected officials at all levels of government. Often it is said that government budgets are balanced on the backs of the poor. Certainly over the last quarter of a century, that has happened. There has been an observable redistribution scheme underway, the most disturbing one this country has ever seen, from poor women and children to middle-class social welfare professionals. We need to reverse the process, redirecting resources from the coffers of stagnant social service agencies to the pockets of poor families, to those with no other source of income, as well as those who live in waged poverty. Decades of half-truths, myth-making, and downright lies, usually for political ends, have gone into stirring up confusion regarding welfare, the people who receive it, and what to do about it. We must see the problem of poverty for what it is in order to pursue appropriate remedies. Perhaps the most powerful deceit has evolved from the complementary myths that A, poor families suffer from an inordinate degree of dependency, and B, job and training programs are a panacea for curing dependency. In part, these ingrained beliefs stem from the failure to recognize the unique circumstances of mothers on welfare, the facts that welfare is a women's issue and the lack of income, not work, is what keeps women and their children poor. In spite of increasing acknowledgement of the povertization of women, there has been no effort of any magnitude on either the local or national level to stem the tide. Mostly, when policy experts recommend solutions, they miss the boat by failing to discern the distinctly different nature of women's poverty because of children and labor force segregation compared with that of men. On the one hand, they don't understand the problem. On the other, they are inherently pitted against the very people they are supposed to be helping as they continue to carve out an ever larger share of the pie for themselves. The combination of self-perpetuating social welfare agencies, which run the gamut from foundations to service providers, and weak, ineffective, or corrupt politicians, is quite literally lethal. If the waged market won't or can't adequately absorb everyone who needs money to buy the basics, and the helping hands are more like a punch in the face, what social policy makes sense? Income security, or a social security system that is truly universal, disassociated from phony distinctions that save one family and throw another away. If income is the problem, then income must be in the solution, a kinder, gentler, simpler, more generous system of resource distribution, one that does not stigmatize and further alienate those who receive it. The real need of poor families to live with dignity can only be met by increasing cash assistance to them. Providing a universal system for true income security in this country is possible. Currently, it is off our political table. It hasn't always been that way, and it doesn't have to stay that way. Not many years after mothers' pensions or wages were won in different states in the early 20th century, a program came into being that would radically alter the lens through which the nation viewed itself. For the first time, the federal government accepted a measure of responsibility for the economy's inability to absorb everyone successfully. Poverty was largely deemed a consequence of multiple environmental factors. Despite much opposition, in 1935, the Social Security Act became law. President Roosevelt and his Committee on Economic Security hoped it would safeguard against misfortune which cannot be wholly eliminated in the man-made world of ours. It had its flaws. From the start, it aimed to protect men, and only incidentally their families, from the vagaries of the marketplace. Mostly white men, many of the jobs originally left out of the Social Security package were those employing larger numbers of people of color and or women. Nonetheless, it was intended to ensure most citizens in or related to someone in certain jobs, but not mothers separated from living husbands. The elderly men, by more than 2 to 1 because of their labor force participation rates then, were designated beneficiaries of old age insurance. It was also this bill that created unemployment compensation systems, particularly intended to cover males temporarily disjointed from the wage labor market. It also provided for the care of, quote, crippled children. Widows, the good single mothers' wives, and their children were to receive survivor's benefits. Early on, if the father divorced his wife shortly before he died, she was now eligible for his Social Security benefits. Children with living but absent fathers were almost left out. Fortunately, enough political pressure was brought to bear to include them in the act in a separate program first called Aid to Dependent Children, ADC. Kids on ADC were presumed to live with their mothers, as in fact almost all did, but no sum of money was designated for the women. That was lost in the political struggle. It wasn't until the 1950s that the caretaker parent was added to the beneficiary unit, and ADC was changed to AFDC, or Aid to Families with Dependent Children. The Social Security Act also created the program everybody loves and calls the real thing, Social Security. Many people believe the elderly receive these benefits because they paid for them as workers in their pre-retirement years. Not so. Not quite. Not everybody. Right off the bat, people who qualified for Social Security never put in enough to get out the amount they would receive. In recent years, this became so obvious that huge increases in Social Security taxes were imposed on current workers. This was not only ostensibly to secure their futures, but also to cover the shortfall on the bill for current Social Security beneficiaries. Social Security is an income transfer program. In that sense, it is similar to welfare. The financing comes out of current taxes. It also happens to make good public policy. For one, people who would otherwise have been poor would have caused an even greater drain on community resources than they currently do. In fact, the very existence of these monthly checks through which basic needs are sustained is beneficial to the economy as it spurs production to meet consumer demand. These are not dollars that would be spent on junkets to see the world. The political strength of Social Security is ample evidence of its popularity. Those who get it actively resist any attempt to tamper with it. A simple political principle stabilizes it. It is much harder to take benefits away from people than it is to withhold something they do not yet have. When the people currently receiving the benefits, plus those who expect to one day, plus those who would have to support their parents without Social Security, constitute the majority of the population, any attempt to take this program away would be political suicide. Although some people get less than others, and for some the dollar amount is insufficient, compared with welfare and in general, Social Security is a great thing. Those who qualify get a check every month, period. Cradle-to-grave security for everyone was not always perceived as a dirty, unhealthy, unwise, or impossible goal. In fact, some people have it, let's face it. Inheriting grandfather's fortune has nothing to do with inalienable rights. It's just the law and the luck of the draw. With respect to parentage, that is. It isn't the consequence of superior moral behavior. Social policy in the United States has done far better at the grave end of the meter than at the cradle end. In healthcare, social and technological advances have been focused far more on extending and improving the quality of life for older people than on protecting children from the ravages of disease, accidents, malnutrition, or despair. In fact, most public healthcare dollars are spent on the elderly through Medicaid and Medicare. Although Medicaid was originally set up particularly to provide healthcare to poor children and families, as a practical matter, most Medicaid expenditures are spent on people over the age of 65, especially for long-term care. Three times as many Medicaid dollars are spent on people over 65 as on those under 21. Nevertheless, the political liability is generally charged against welfare families. The more the, quote, undeserving poor, unquote, welfare families seem to get, the less politically viable future programs perceived to be for them become. What they end up with is not more targeted dollars, but the implication that through these expenditures they are getting more than their social share. Politicians who chatter incessantly about the growth in welfare spending aren't talking about cash assistance through AFDC unless they're serious dunces. Remember, AFDC is less than 1% of the federal budget and has fallen. It is microscopic compared with the tonnage that will be used to bail out the savings and loans. It is also less than 1/4 the cost of Medicaid. And that doesn't touch Medicare, which is exclusively for older populations. What politicians are really most often talking about when they assert the growth in welfare spending is Medicaid, knowing most people will presume that welfare used this way will trigger thoughts of slovenly but healthy adults who spend their days watching TV, spend their nights making babies, drive around in Cadillacs, and eat roast beef three nights a week. For the most part, they won't admit it, but but sometimes politicians are covertly talking about Social Security expenditures, also entitlements, which have soared in recent decades. With the exception of single women over the age of 85 who live alone, poverty among the elderly in the United States has declined considerably in recent decades. In 1969, children were less likely than men aged 65 to 69 to be poor. Children in larger families had always tended to be poorer, but children in smaller ones, which are increasingly common, had not. With minimum wages, public assistance benefits, and even average wages tumbling in purchasing power, children in many kinds of households are poor and are steadily getting more desperately poor. By 1979, the children of our country were twice as likely as older men to be poor. From 1966 on, the well-being of children relative to the elderly has virtually reversed itself. The single most dramatic and obvious factor increasing the economic well-being of the elderly has been the expansion of Social Security benefits, cash transfers for retirees. They have increased, they have been progressively adjusted, and they cover more categories of people than ever before. We have achieved the lowest rate of poverty of the elderly in the nation's history. Most cash assistance is spent through old age insurance, Social Security, and it now covers the preponderance of older citizens. Whatever its shortcomings, for most of those who get it, Social Security and government-funded health care are damn good things. Although created for poor children, AFDC is the most miserly program of income transfers in the nation. Unlike Social Security, AFDC is distributed on a case-by-case basis with enough strings to hang an elephant. It is meanly administered, hard to qualify for, hard to keep. It provides insufficient benefits and is tough to stomach with all its invasive attempts at behavior modification. Some children get Social Security benefits even though their parents are gainfully employed. There are a variety of ways this can happen. For instance, upon the death of a parent, most commonly the father, survivors can receive Social Security. Even if the mother has never spent a day in the wage labor market herself, she and her children are often covered by these relatively generous survivor benefits. The mother is neither expected nor required to get a job in order to receive them. No one worries about her, quote, dependency on the system. What is the intrinsic difference between a survivor family and one with an alive but absent father who either refuses to or can't support his children? Not much. The needs and rights of women and children are not determined by some just and universal standard, but by the nature and sometimes the duration of their prior relationship to a man. The federal government sets Social Security payments. At a minimum, depending on the political climate, benefits are increased annually, indexed to keep pace with inflation. Per capita, average monthly benefits on Social Security are more than four times those for AFDC recipients. By contrast, each state sets its own level of cash assistance in the AFDC program. No amount is too little. Subsequent to a Supreme Court ruling in 1970, every state was obligated to specify an actual standard of need for recipients, but was not required to pay it. The court made allowances for a state to accommodate budgetary realities. Translation: the difference between what the state pays and what people need constitutes the basis for future political discourse, which should facilitate increasing welfare benefits over time, mostly in their dreams. Budgetary flimflam, benign neglect by the mediating institutions representing the poor, and political hardball have all contributed to the plummeting of the purchasing power of AFDC benefits nationwide. Welfare families have nearly always been the Willie Hortons of politics among both the Democrats and Republicans. It only became advantageous to complain about the Horton advertisements when the Dems felt like translating it into an overtly racial issue. The fact is, although most welfare recipients are white, the not-so-silent majority identify race as a principal factor in the welfare equation. Politicians know this and use it, with the tacit complicity emanating from many social welfare agents waiting for contracts and other insider perks. So unlike Social Security, AFDC grants have all fallen far below the poverty line. In the 1960s, just before the slide began, grants were much higher in constant dollars. In some cases, including New York, grants that exceeded the poverty line, however slightly. A widow on Social Security can receive benefits until she dies, and neither social policy experts nor politicians will lose any sleep if she never had or gets a paying job. In fact, if she has small children, she's often presumed to be a better mother for taking care of her children full-time. If and when she were to get a job, she could earn thousands of dollars without a reduction in Social Security. When she reaches an income maximum, cash assistance from the government will still only be reduced 50 cents for every dollar she earns. One cultural effect of this form of resource distribution is that it acknowledges the working role of at least some mothers in the home. Another grouping of women in recent years have seen some change in the perception of their value in the home is divorced women. Some can now receive Social Security benefits through their deceased or retired husband's benefits, albeit much less than their husbands get, if they were married at least 10 years before the divorce. Additionally, they can receive substantial community property. Women argued for years that the caring work they did for their husbands and children while the former were out getting paid was of economic consequence to the men individually, to the entire family unit, and to the society. By making it possible for their husbands to optimize their labor force participation and by raising their children to grow up properly socialized, these women contributed to the economy perhaps without ever stepping foot into the paid labor market. Now, in spite of their marital status, they can be rewarded tangibly. Of course, they may not be. Not a few women become displaced homemakers, left with nothing after divorce, sometimes becoming homeless. The pressure to leave small children and enter the wage labor market falls most heavily on welfare mothers. Even though it is generally conceded that the labor market is tight and good child care rare, when it comes to welfare mothers, virtually everyone wants them out. Here's where somebody says that the majority of mothers in the United States work outside the home whether they want to or not, so why shouldn't welfare mothers? But of those mothers who work at paying jobs, most do not work full-time year-round, and they work only if doing so improves the economic condition of their families. If the welfare mother makes such a move, outside minimal work-related expenses, for the most part, her welfare check is reduced $1 for every dollar she is paid. In other words, her government check is taxed at a 100% rate. With a wage job, she tends to be as poor or even poorer than she was on straight welfare. I used to tell largely female audiences, quote, if you think he's going to walk out on you, shoot him. Then you'll get to be a widow, unquote. The tasks are endless, especially for women with very young children, who are the bulk of women on welfare. The job is tough no matter what, and tougher when you lack basic subsistence resources. It is true that all poor mothers are not great at the job of parenting. But neither are all mothers of any class. Good mothering is on a function of class. It is also the case that not all welfare mothers wish to stay in the home. Having been a welfare mother and having worked over the years with thousands of other welfare mothers, I can say with some confidence that if there is one generalization about us that remains consistent, it is that as a group, we are very much like the rest of society, all different. Many have less education and most a tougher hide, but otherwise, we span the gamut as mothers, cooks, thinkers, doers, givers and users, housekeepers and gadabouts. The spread of wage labor, especially from the mid-19th century on, changed the meaning of the word work, with dire consequences for women. Until then, most families' toil was at the very least independent of an employer, so what was called and conceived of as work was the everyday life of creating and producing subsistence, both inside and outside the home. Quote, women's work was primarily in and very near the home, nurturing children, obeying husbands, tending to household matters, and maybe feeding chickens or tending a garden for flowers and food. Certainly it was work and critical to the functioning of the family and community. It still is. It is even acknowledged for certain classes of women, but not for poor ones. In part because it is not waged or usually in any sufficient way rewarded with the primary means of resource distribution in today's culture, money. Quote, women's work has lost its extrinsic value. As Robin Morgan puts it, women's, quote, labor is too revered to be demeaned by wages, unquote. The introduction of the wage system may have been problematic for lower-class men, but mothers and women in general lost big time. Women's valuelessness in the home extends to the paid labor market, where by tradition, they are poorly remunerated. As late as 1989, nearly three-fourths of single mothers with children under age 6 received less than half the median family income in the United States. 47% received less than one-fourth. White women fare only slightly better than black women, with Hispanic women close behind. Men of all races fare better than women of all races, on average. The woman who exits from welfare, as sooner or later almost all do, may have higher self-esteem than she had before, but she rarely benefits in dollars, sans marriage, that is. A black woman hired as a nanny for an upper-class white family is a worker, as a mother laboring in the shadow of the wage under adverse conditions to raise her own children on welfare. She is considered a parasite on society. Under certain circumstances, her work is socially sanctioned, as when it is performed in exchange for a wage, whether or not it improves the material condition of the family. Unless the poor waged mother has a trusted relative or friend who will take care of her children, she must entrust her small child to the cheapest alternative and her older child to the mercy of the neighborhood. Her stress quotient soars if the local junkies take an interest in her son or the bargain babysitter turns out to be a child molester. She lives with the consequences and faces the stigma of being blamed for not being at home when the kids needed her. The trap is sprung. If every mother is a working mother, then every poor mother is a member of the working poor. So why do so many political creatures, left, right, and center, believe that a welfare mother is, by definition, an unproductive human being who is suffering from a nearly terminal disease, dependency, which can be only cured by a job? As Daniel Patrick Moynihan put it in 1972, if American society recognized homemaking and child-rearing as productive work to be included in the national economic accounts, the receipt of welfare might not imply dependency. But we don't. It may be hoped that the women's movement of the present time will change this. The JAMA training programs so prevalent today are rarely much more than mechanisms of torture. Let's face it, if they really work, why is participation in most of them restricted to welfare mothers? Why, for instance, aren't widows on Social Security offered training slots? Surely if anyone deserves a shot at self-improvement, they do, not to mention the fact that their benefits cost us all more. If asked, every governor in the country can probably point to a half dozen women who were actually helped by one of these programs. Certainly they are not going to point out any failures, in spite of the overwhelming evidence that the programs do not produce jobs or employ many women who would not otherwise have become employed outside the home. And the majority of the programs are costly. We're talking economics 101 here, not human costs. If the mothers who do get great jobs remain poor or near poor, where's the return on our investment? Irrespective of how or whether we measure work, there was a proposal on the country's table that could have made all the difference in the world. It was hotly debated, but it never became the law of the land. It is an old idea, guaranteed income. What does that mean? Alan Sheehan put it succinctly in his book, Guaranteed Income, quote, "It's a plan based on the principle that everyone has the right to live. It would provide every American with a minimum level of income, enough for food, shelter, and basic necessities. It is a floor below which no income can fall." Unquote. 30 years after the Social Security Act, another truly significant package of social reforms was attempted. It would come to include a proposal for guaranteed income. The foundation for President Johnson's Great Society was laid by the Kennedy administration, which wished to put poverty on notice. Income maintenance was ruled out immediately. It was thought to breed the degenerative social disease, dependency. President Johnson declared his war on poverty in part because he felt some political imperative to pick up where Kennedy had left off, but especially because big spending programs aimed at reducing the effects of poverty had been his political turf as far back as Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and the Social Security Act. Also, Johnson grew up poor and came from a generally poor community when he was first elected to Congress. Unquestionably, on the issue of poverty, his roots were deeper than Kennedy's. Some of his advisors recommended an income maintenance strategy, guaranteed income, to him early on, but like Kennedy, he rejected it, at least at first. It is likely that he did so for political, not ideological reasons. Later on, Johnson appointed a commission on income maintenance programs, which continued into the Nixon administration. Barbara Jordan, then a Texas state senator, was one of the few commission members not from the business community. Robert Harris, who headed the staff of the commission, maintains that Johnson knew at the outset that the committee would end up endorsing the creation of a universal income supplement to all members of the population in need. According to Harris, Johnson appointed such stalwart capitalists as Ben Heineman, president of Northwest Industries, IBM's Thomas Watson, and the Rand Corporation's Henry Rowan to the commission in order to lend weight from the business community to the intended mandate for increased income security. Allaire Townsend, also on the staff to the commission, says that Heineman was appointed chair specifically because he had already expressed a conviction that income security was the only true method for addressing poverty. Harris maintains that because there were so many others on the commission with less background in the issue who needed to be brought up to snuff, consequently its conclusions were handed to President Nixon. There was minimal dissent among the commission members. Most of the dissenters simply argued for more income as the starting point. Others wanted to place greater emphasis on creating quality childcare in addition to income supplements to allow more freedom of choice. If Johnson wanted the commission to make these recommendations, why did he bog down the war on poverty with all the surface and economic development schemes? The decline in the industrial base was already limiting certain jobs, and democratic reform movements had put a stranglehold on party machines accustomed to wielding power through the jobs they controlled. The war on poverty must have seemed an excellent chance to rebuild the party machine, with particular allegiance to him. So services emerged with regularity, each new need defined by the helping industry and by elected officials shagging dollars or votes. The Great Society programs were the perfect storm for distributing patronage on a grand scale. Community Action, Vista, Model Cities. The service-cum-economic development strategy was to achieve a marriage of otherwise feuding factions, mayors, poor people, what first had cause for optimism, civil rights leaders, liberals, and the press, complete with a dowry no one would reject. Were it not for the Vietnam War, Johnson had every reason to believe his re-election was in the bag. His programs were shoring up a deteriorating political machine while providing the rhetorical posture for an end to poverty. No such political advantage derived from expanding simple cash assistance programs. Input by poor people was all but non-existent. Affluent citizens who happened to live in a target area could represent the poor. The law could therefore be observed without having a single low-income person on the board. This was exactly the case in the early days of the Atlanta CAA, where the only person who could claim to be a representative of the poor, within the vague criteria of the provision, was Martin Luther King Sr., a minister living in the poverty area. Participation of poor people on a national scale that would make a difference never really took place. Only the appearance occurred, as my own experience in the 1970s confirmed. The mirage of participation had considerable value to the agencies, though. The impact of the civil rights, women's, and welfare rights movements was felt strongly through the 70s, so it was politically uncouth for advantaged parties to act without input from the disadvantaged. By manipulating the input, the social welfare establishment could appear to address poverty issues with the imprimatur of poor people, most commonly women on welfare. The resulting aura of equity made it easier to get and maintain government and private foundation grants. The pretense of poor people's participation thus legitimized the social welfare institutions. In 1962 and 1967, amendments to the Social Security Act were passed. They also impelled the services solution. The First Amendment moved to increase the state's revenue share for family services, programs that utilized and paid for social workers as opposed to income maintenance going directly to recipients, from 50 to 75%. The second allowed states to contract these services out to non-governmental agencies. Previously, local welfare departments were the sole service providers using federal dollars. States that had previously and systematically denied welfare benefits to millions of needy families, especially black families, were now eager to qualify for the windfall revenue sharing, but they had to find people categorically eligible for welfare. Furthermore, states would actually have to pay the families' welfare benefits, which were also federally subsidized, but not so liberally in most cases. Not to worry, because cash assistance levels were set by the states, It was A, possible to find families eligible for welfare to leverage the federal service dollars, and B, set AFDC levels so low that families would stay poor. The welfare rolls climbed so fast that the phenomenon was characterized as an explosion. This legislated windfall to states, combined with the war on poverty strategy of delivering megabucks to state and local governments for services to the poor, set off a spending spree that was peaking just when the purchasing power of AFDC benefits began to decline. The decrease in welfare benefits was coupled with an increase in rhetoric about dependency and the necessity for women to work. In due time, both President Johnson and President Nixon attempted to insert guaranteed income into U.S. domestic policy. George McGovern also proposed a form of guaranteed income in his 1972 bid against Nixon for the presidency. President Nixon introduced Congress and the nation to the Family Assistance Plan, which could have made a giant leap on the road to guaranteed income. In essence, FAP would have replaced our present welfare system with a guaranteed minimum income. In effect, it would have been similar to extending Social Security to those currently unprotected from the vagaries of the wage labor market and the realities of child rearing. In order to overcome perceived potential disruption of the labor market, people who had low wage employment would also receive some cash assistance from the government. The higher the job pay, the lower the government checks would be. Again, it was similar to Social Security, although its initial levels of support were not as generous, and the tax back began with the first dollar earned. The econometric model employed was referred to as a negative income tax, the theoretical paradigm usually attributed to conservative economist Milton Friedman. Support for and opposition to FAP were as complex as for any issue in the nation's history. NWRO wanted a higher income standard set from the beginning and the work requirements canned. All groups were divided on the issue for a host of reasons, not the least of which was work. The President's Commission never intended forced work requirements to be a prerequisite to guaranteed income. But to make it politically palatable to some of the naysayers, Nixon's people inserted what were considered strong forced work components. The National Welfare Rights Organization argued that mothering was work, and mothers should be exempted from work requirements, at least until they stopped being their children's primary caretakers. Some opponents were apoplectic at the thought that guaranteed income would discourage work and virtually destroy the economy. In a sense, they were talking about two different populations. At the time, welfare mothers were generally not expected to work, and the new provisions would not force them into a program until after their youngest child turned 6. Most welfare mothers have a small child in the home, so they would not have been affected. The real and most pervasive fear was that virtually the entire working class would opt out of the labor market if they were not forced to work. And the higher the income level without forced work, the more likely people would be to reject work altogether. So if there wasn't much faith in the welfare population, when it came down to it, there was almost none in the so-called working class either. In my view, the working class and the welfare population are really the same, entering and exiting one status or the other as fate and personal circumstances change. People unfamiliar with the history of income maintenance are often surprised to learn that a conservative economist, Milton Friedman, developed the negative income tax model, and a Republican President Nixon first proposed a bill to implement it. As a practical and political matter, though, it makes sense. In theory, this plan wiped out much of the entrenched, multi-layered, self-perpetuating welfare bureaucracy. It would have been simple to administer. It would not have been cheap, but it would have been clean. It also potentially cut into the social service sector, a bastion predominantly cornered by Democrats, and its work incentives kept employment desirable by subsidizing low-wage work. On December 13, 1970, President Nixon addressed the decennial White House Conference on Children. The great issue concerning family and child welfare in the United States is the issue of family income. For generations, social thinkers have argued that there is such a thing as a minimum necessary family income, and that no family should be required to subsist on less. It is a simple idea, but profound in its consequences. On August 11, 1969, I proposed for the first time in America's history we establish a floor under the income of every American family with children. We called it the Family Assistance Plan. It has in turn been called the most important piece of social legislation in our nation's history. You know the story of this legislation. In April, it passed the House of Representatives by a margin of almost 2-1. Then it became mired down in the Senate. It is still stuck, but it is not lost. There is still an opportunity for the 91st Congress to change the world of American children by enacting family assistance. The welfare system has become a consuming, monstrous, inhuman outrage against the community, against the family, against the individual, and most of all against the very children whom it was supposed to help. We have taken long strides toward ending racial segregation, but welfare segregation can be almost as insidious. Think what it can mean to a sensitive child. To take only one example, the free lunch program. The welfare children are herded into an auditorium for their free lunch, while the others bring their lunches and eat in the classroom. We have got to find ways of ending this sort of separation. The point is the stigmatizing by separation of the welfare children as welfare children. Nixon went on to describe his own experiences of poverty, back in the Depression at some length. Then he returned to say, quote, "Today's welfare child is not so fortunate. His family may have enough to get by on. They may even have more in a material sense than many of us did in those Depression years. But no matter how much pride and courage his parents have, he knows they are poor, and he can feel that soul-stifling, patronizing attitude that follows the dole. Perhaps he watches while a caseworker, himself trapped in a system that wastes on policing talents that could be used for helping, while this caseworker is forced by the system to poke around in the child's apartment, checking on how the money is spent, or whether his mother might be hiding his father in the closet. This sort of indignity is hard enough on the mother, enough of a blow to her pride and self-respect, but think what it must mean to a sensitive child. We have a chance now to give that child a chance to grow up without having a schoolmate throw in his face the fact that he is on welfare, and without making him feel that he is therefore something less than other children. Our task is not only to lift people out of poverty, but from the standpoint of the child, to erase the stigma of welfare and illegitimacy and apartness, to restore pride and dignity and self-respect. I do not contend that our family assistance plan is perfect, but it is a good program, and a program immensely better than what we have now. For the Senate to adjourn without enacting this measure would be a tragedy of missed opportunity for America." End quote. They did, and it was. The family assistance plan was flawed. It certainly didn't provide enough money to lift families out of poverty, for instance. Social Security didn't do that in the beginning either. But the longer FAP held out, the worse it got. As lobbyists from every conceivable corner found fault with it or tried to make it advance their own agendas. Given the strength and diversity of the opposition, FAP was doomed. It seems clear today, however, that FAP in its original form could have changed everything about the politics of poverty and set a universal standard minimum income irrespective of employment status. While Nixon has hardly been remembered as a liberal tax and spend kind of guy, for reasons that only he could tell us, failing to pass FAP remains one of his greatest disappointments. So he says. But there is also a political basis that he could not have missed. At some point, if people have sufficient income to live decently, they have less need for the social service agencies. Republicans have occasionally dented the political allegiance most of these have for the Democratic Party, but they have never achieved a significant shift. When the Republicans control the patronage, studies may produce more conservative results and conclusions, but even with a Republican president, most of the minutiae of social service patronage are controlled by Congress, which has been dominated for Democrats for decades. Republicans have had more success in controlling military patronage. They are not above it. So whether Nixon wanted to end poverty or whether he wanted to shrink the size of the active opposition isn't clear. It was probably some of both, not unlike Johnson's probable impetus for the Great Society. Important principles died with the bill. Unfortunately, though we didn't get the good parts of FAP, we do have its worst aspects. Forced work and spurious training programs embedded in our current welfare system, as well as all the mess we had before, plus some. After Nixon abandoned FAP, the professionalization of being human took off again. Bloating under government contracts. For every poverty problem, a self-perpetuating profession proposed to ameliorate the situation without altering the poverty itself. In The Politics of a Guaranteed Income, published in 1973, Daniel Patrick Moynihan noted the astonishing consistency with which middle-class professionals, quote, improved the condition of lower-class groups by devising schemes that would first improve their own condition. Neither simple efficiency nor social justice was to get in the way for some time to come. Like the 19th-century opponents of outdoor relief, today's stars of social welfare keep the service engine stoked by ascribing every manner of failure to the families: laziness, cheating, dependency, drugs, ignorance. The families lack the resources to defend themselves, though the helping institutions always have government and our foundation funds to lobby, ostensibly in the family's behalf, for more funding to fix these deficient humans. This time around, the service sector is more powerful than ever, buttressed by a litany of social scientific material produced to prove hypotheses that keep its proverbial pockets bulging with a bounty of good intentions. Coined by Ken Alota, the term underclass deserves special attention because its implications have spawned more questionable social policy in recent years than almost any other social discovery, and it helped to deep six any public discussion of increasing incomes for millions of welfare families. These were drug addicts, criminals, the psychologically traumatized, and welfare mothers. Alota noticed that the mothers were most successful in the program. As a result, he took it upon himself to promote workfare for welfare mothers. If he had understood how out of whack their very placement in the grouping was, his findings would not have come as much of a surprise. Beyond that, why he looked favorably on the behavior modification strategy, forced work, without considering the host of issues like childcare that emanated from it, is baffling. Why didn't he question the wisdom of removing mothers from direct caretaking, irrespective of their skills, desires, or family needs, if his theory of this deviant underclass, grouped together in given neighborhoods, were indeed accurate? Why leave children without parental supervision in a dangerous neighborhood, just so their mother can, quote, work and stay poor? Alota's book helped consolidate the chorus of policymakers around the need for well-fed mothers to get out of the house, be trained, and work. He had observed a very small universe for only a few weeks. A group of 26 trainees became the narrative spine for the book. Alota nevertheless generalized his observations, and few serious academics challenged the soundness of extracting so much from so little. Ever since, innumerable political scientists, journalists, and to some extent even the general population have used Alota's term, bemoaned the genesis and woes of the underclass, ignored the offensive notion embodied in the very word, and made recommendations on what to do about it, often without so much as stepping foot into the neighborhoods involved. A barrage of like-minded literature helped to reaffirm ever-increasing workfare demands by politicians and bureaucrats. It culminated in another welfare reform bill in 1988, which resulted in all kinds of behavior modification strategies, including sexual practices, eugenics, but didn't bother with the issues of helping mothers and their families out of poverty. Another academic whose writing massaged the political process for the workfare movement is Lawrence Mead. He contends that welfare is a one-sided equation. Welfare families get something for nothing, therein breaking the implicit social contract between the individual and society. Mead will not concede that the social contract was broken from the start, as welfare families are denied any real participation in the political process or other benefits of our society, and the labor of mothers is so denigrated as to seem non-existent. During one televised debate, he argued that the social contract does not require that mothers get jobs paying enough to overcome poverty. It merely requires that the mothers work if they get welfare. Between this social contract rhetoric, which caught on handily, the repulsion against longer-term recipients, the illegitimacy question, and the concern for or about the underclass, welfare reform was all but inevitable. In the great welfare reform debates of the late 1980s, social welfare professionals fell all over each other, running after more funding through the jobs, training, and childcare provisions of the so-called welfare reform bill, ironically presided over by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, usually credited as the architect of FAP. Forgotten were the words of the President's Commission on Income Maintenance 2 decades earlier. Quote, services cannot be a substitute for adequate incomes. They cannot pay rent or buy food for a poor family. Unquote. The few surviving organizations of welfare mothers put guaranteed income at the top of their lists, but they are rarely listened to. After all, they have no money. What stalled the Reform Act for months was the issue of how much money to allocate for running the job training programs, and a turf war over whether they would be run by welfare departments or contracted out to private charities. Everybody knew getting women to work didn't mean getting them out of poverty, so there wasn't any time wasted worrying about their financial condition. In New York, Russell Sykes, then at State Communities Aid Association, even circulated a paper on how the agencies who got the contracts would have to bite the bullet and participate in cutting off the rolls women who didn't comply, the ultimate burden of doing good in the 90s. One of the other things most everybody in the field knew but wouldn't say was that the work programs don't really work, so to speak, for many reasons. One is that in a contracting labor market, there simply aren't jobs for the millions of women who would be forced into them. Not to mention, these programs cost more than straight income maintenance does, and everything has pretty much been tried before without success. Most of what the millions of dollars spent on multiple studies showed was already known from programs that had existed for years. About a decade ago, at a welfare rights workshop in Texas, a woman from Kentucky on what was then called the Work Incentive Program, WIN, gave a vivid description of her interview with a WIN worker. I wrote some of it down, as close to verbatim as I could. Quote, she asks me what I made on my last job. She asks me what I'd like to make. Well, I'd like to make nothing less than $1,000 an hour. Who she thinks she's kidding? She wastes my time with a whole list of bull-do while she's just trying to stretch the interview to lunch. She asks me what I think I can do well, and I say I can do her job. At least I wouldn't waste time. She says I don't care how fast you can type. All we have are dishwashing jobs. So what did she waste my time with all that bull-do for? End quote. 2 decades ago, the Milwaukee County Welfare Rights Organization had a book published. Chapter 3 is called Poverty Pimps. Early on it reads, quote, so who really benefits from the poverty program? The people who run it. Since the birth of the Office of Economic Opportunity in 1964, hundreds of corporations have found that they can get richer off poverty itself, end quote. The failure of most of the jobs programs targeting welfare recipients had been known for years, not the least of the informed or the welfare mothers themselves. There was really nothing new under this sun, so what was going on? There can be little doubt that at least from the 1970s in the 1990s, welfare reemerged in social policy debates as a largely negative force in our culture and economy, having staggering implications for both societal and individual development. This sentiment achieved a rare consensus, embraced for varying reasons by most of the left, right, and center. They were so uniformly focused on the question of work, independent of income, that it became difficult to distinguish the ideologies underpinning these sort of proposals to fix the system. Oddly, many of the policy experts redoubling their efforts for forced work at any wage for welfare mothers were concurrently crying the blues about the loss of high-paying industrial jobs suffered primarily by men. Watch a rerun of any of a number of speeches delivered by Bill Clinton during the presidential campaign. For many reasons, the tendency to exaggerate the successes has dominated public discourse. A 7%, or 1%, or 10% success rate is common. In other words, the proven failure rate of the programs is 90% or more. That hasn't stopped politicians in the social welfare industry from clamoring for ever more funds from Congress. As Texas politician Jim Hightower says, job training for what? He argues that there are millions of people in the country who are already trained, highly educated, and skilled, who can't get jobs because the jobs aren't there. At some point, even Congress will have to do a reality check, if for no other reason than because the cost of the programs far exceeds their benefits. The red herring that welfare to work has become should sink of its own weight. When it does, there could and should be a reopening of debate on income security, independent of one's relationship to waged work, i.e., guaranteed income. We have to stop and ask how we can condemn millions of people to lives of desperate poverty when we have been unable to offer any real way out. A majority of U.S. families are teetering on the brink of poverty. They may not be permanently or presently poor, but any of a number of possible calamities, job loss, death of a provider, illness, could push them over the edge. In his book Equality, William Ryan postulates, quote, included in this vulnerable majority, who have an even chance of spending some portion of their lives in economic distress, are perhaps 3 out of 4 Americans, end quote. Many millions of people who only a few years ago felt secure in their jobs have recently experienced the reality of downward mobility. For some, new jobs will come at lower wages. For others, the condition of poverty will become permanent. Even if and when the unemployed return to paid work, their pockets often remain virtually empty. Two major trends in employment patterns in the United States are altering the direction of our economy. The most profound is the increase in service sector jobs, public and private. The greatest growth in that sector has occurred at the bottom of the wage scale, with some growth in the middle and a somewhat larger growth at the top. In production industries, technological advances, especially via computers, are creating the second major trend, the elimination of jobs. As a result, far fewer paid jobs have been created than eliminated. The roboticization of the workplace outside the home divides the labor process, that the work of those at the bottom becomes increasingly de-skilled, that is, largely rote. This tendency also diminishes middle-level positions and disintegrates the ladder of opportunity that remains the myth of entry-level employment. It is a trend that doesn't appear to be letting up. In the early 80s, estimates in Fortune magazine, for instance, predicted that further decimation of production jobs by one-third to one-half by the end of that decade. By 1990, concurrent economist Robert Theobald, quote, the installation of 10 to 20,000 robots will create up to 5,000 new jobs for robot technicians, but the robots will replace 50,000 auto workers. Ford Motor Company alone announced that it would lay off 75,000 workers in 1992. The auto industry in this country is in freefall. Also in 1992, for the first time in its history, IBM, which had long touted its job security, announced the layoffs of 25,000 workers. The list is long and growing. Not only have the trades lost jobs, but many upper-middle-class jobs have gone and are going down the tubes, too. The growing service sector, which has traditionally been dominated by men and women of color, is also becoming rife with technological displacement. By 1994, AT&T will complete its phase-out of a third of its remaining operators. Many had already been phased out with the introduction of long-distance dialing. Recordings will do the talking from now on. Cutting out many operators also cut out managers, and anticipated 200 to 400 of their jobs are gone too. Anyone with a bank cash card has had the opportunity to experience the almost eerie quality of midnight banking with no other human being in sight. The flood of catalogs clogging every mailbox speaks volumes in the lot of salespeople in stores. It won't be long before we push buttons at McDonald's and burgers pop out. Estimates of the loss of even high-paying and finance jobs on Wall Street exclusively as a result of technological advances reach well into the 20% range, in spite of a relatively robust stock market. According to one recent congressional report, 9.2 million workers lost their jobs over the 5 years from 1985 to 1989 due to plant closings or relocation, elimination of a position or shift or slack work. The nation's productivity boom is taking place independent of opportunities for better standards of living, or even the maintenance of their present standard for many people. If the strongest workers in the labor force, white men, continue losing relatively better paying jobs, i.e. steel production, automobile manufacturing, middle management, even finance, and continue a downward spiral into lower wage work, it is not too difficult to guess who will get pushed out altogether. Women and men of color, for whom the ladder of opportunity was rarely more than a footstool in the past, can expect even less in the future if nothing is done. On March 22, 1964, the Ad Hoc Committee on the Triple Revolution sent President Johnson a most prescient and now obscure memorandum analyzing the future of the United States along three major lines of inquiry. 1, the cybernation revolution. 2, the weaponry revolution. And 3, the human rights revolution. The document was signed by a number of notables of the time, most of whom are still active in some way in our collective political life. Only a couple of women were on this committee, Alice Mary Hilton and Dr. Frances W. Herring. The only reference to women is in the last paragraph. Ironically, in just a few short years, the movement that would have the most profound and enduring effect on a national and worldwide level would be the women's movement. For all intents and purposes, to this committee, as to many others, women were invisible. As far as it goes, the document and its underlying premises are nonetheless applicable and even more readily understandable today than when they were written. The greatest attention was paid to the cybernation revolution. I'll take that up last. Vis-a-vis the weaponry revolution. They were right on the money. They argued that because world destruction would be the inevitable consequence of using any of a number of developed and developing weapons, war as a means of resolving international conflicts would begin to disappear. Little did they know that the Vietnam War was just heating up. They were not naive. They understood that eliminating war would be a slow and frustrating process. The big bomb theory postulated a decreased need for vast military assets, especially in the form of people power. Jobs and concomitant expenditures created by the military complex would diminish. Defense spending would become a smaller portion of the gross national products of the United States and other countries. They didn't use the term New World Order, but that's what they were talking about. Their human rights revolution predicted a universal demand for full human rights. It was clear to them that justice, as evidenced by a fair share of economic and social rights in this country for blacks, would not be met. Quote, "The Negro is trying to enter a social community and a tradition of work and income, which are in the process of vanishing even for the hitherto privileged white worker. The U.S. operates on the thesis that every person will be able to obtain a job if he wishes to do so, and that this job will provide him with the resources adequate to live and maintain a family decently. Job holding is the general mechanism through which economic resources are distributed. Those without jobs can function as only minimum consumers. As a result, the goods and services which are needed by these crippled consumers, and which they would buy if they could, are not produced. This in turn deprives other workers of jobs, thus reducing their incomes and consumption. In the opinion of the committee, a just outcome in the human rights revolution depended on the outcomes of the other two revolutions, and the responsible development of social policy in reaction to all three. Keep in mind that these were peak Cold War years. The Berlin Wall was up and the USSR bound tightly. The fax generation wasn't begun, nor had VCRs, cable TV, PCs like the one I'm working on, or many other time-saving or entertainment devices become commonplace. The fastest and certainly up there with the most profound change in human history is the cybernetic revolution. The interaction of human behavior and the virtually cosmic changes being wrought by complex electronic computers. The agricultural revolution took thousands of years. The industrial revolution, hundreds. Cybernation is moving at a warp speed. Unfortunately, many of the politically active signatories of the Triple Revolution memo went on to promote, quote, full employment, even though they believed jobs would continue to evanesce. The social, economic, and political burden placed on those effectively banished from the wage labor market has been one of the cruelest ever provoked by the self-proclaimed progressives. While some men were kicked out of jobs, losing income, homes, and self-respect with few prospects of regaining any of it, poor mothers were being splayed like so much manure into the disappearing field of dreams. Here's the Triple Revolution memo on cybernation. Quote, "In the developing cybernated system, potentially unlimited output can be achieved by systems of machines which will require little cooperation from human beings. The continuance of the income through jobs link to consume now acts as the main brake on the almost unlimited capacity of a cybernated productive system. An adequate distribution of the potential abundance of goods and services will be achieved only when it is understood that the major economic problem is not how to increase production, but how to distribute the abundance that is the great potential of cybernation. Wealth produced by machines rather than men is still wealth. We urge, therefore, that society, through its appropriate legal and governmental institutions, undertake an unqualified commitment to provide every individual and every family with an adequate income as a matter of right." End quote. Societies throughout history relied on slave labor to produce much of their wealth. The ancient Greeks, whose concept of the polis and an active participatory citizenry is part of our strongest, historically acknowledged heritage, felt that toil had limited intrinsic value to individual well-being. In fact, they considered it an impediment to the important things in life. For democracy, for art, for philosophy, for the proper nurturance of future generations, labor was avoided. Our Protestant work ethic colors our perspective. But in an age when computers and robots are displacing people at ever-increasing speed, it is time to reevaluate our system of resource distribution. The values we assign to differing activities in the society, like child rearing, one of the few jobs no one has begun to figure out how to replace by machine, and what a just society can do about it. The Triple Revolution memo predated the findings of the President's Commission on Income Maintenance and the Family Assistance Plan. Each of these was moving firmly in the direction of increased income supports for varying reasons. The time had not yet come. In his 1970 race for a Senate seat, George Bush urged voters to support President Nixon's Family Assistance Plan. His Democratic opponent, Lloyd Benson, made FAP an issue in the race, claiming it would put all Texans on welfare. Bush lost. Robert Kennedy opposed guaranteed income. Eugene McCarthy and George McGovern embraced it. Both used it in their ill-fated presidential campaigns. Support and opposition to it crossed all standard political lines. Dozens of proposals for increasing income security and even eliminating the welfare system as we know it were debated. They included family allowances, negative income taxes, and universal guaranteed income, irrespective of family composition. The Family Assistance Plan was only one among them. It wasn't a hallucination, and it wasn't so long ago. Barely a few years after FAP's defeat, the very mention of income redistribution choked the most liberal of politicos. Certainly, the so-called advocates for the poor kept their mouths shut from the late 70s well into the 90s. They didn't want to jeopardize their government and private foundation support by a whisper with the power of a nuke. We can hope that the fallout is about to dissipate. Still, it surfaced in snippets here and there. During George Bush's 1988 presidential campaign, he proposed a child care tax credit that had all the markings of a backdoor approach to family allowances, albeit for a limited number of children at a low level of payment. It was the one platform piece unanimously adopted by the Republican platform delegates without so much as a dissenting word. It would have supplied income not only to those low-income mothers working outside the home, but also to those in the home. Whether it would have applied to welfare families is debatable. Domestic agendas being his weak suit shortly after the election, Bush gave up on it. Many daycare groups opposed it. They wanted all of whatever money was going to be passed around for childcare to go to themselves. They saw that the package wasn't big enough. It wasn't. And families could choose not to spend it on them. There were some more astute observers who understood the hidden meaning in the Republican proposal. So it wasn't long before some Democrats were calling for it too. Then the shouting match broke out, led by Marion Wright Edelman of the Children's Defense Fund. Those with the true child care package strongly supported a service package, with its emphasis on paying for child care services. Some of the Democratic congressional leaders, such as Representative Tom Downey, were beginning to move toward the choice ethic on the child-rearing question and funding for it. The clash was bitter and drowned out the possibility of compromise. It also muted any serious liberal reconsideration of how the welfare state should progress into the 21st century. Once again, the service sector would opt for nothing for poor women over not enough for themselves. In 1991, Senator Jay Rockefeller's Commission on Children officially reopened the dialogue, recommending a children's allowance as a key to reducing the poverty of U.S. children. Edelman was on the commission and supported its recommendations. Now that she and other Washington advocates were beginning to come on board, maybe the time is approaching when debate shifts to what form income redistribution should take, not whether it should be done. Bob Greenstein, who fronted the opposition to it for Marty Rogall at Hands Across America in the late 1980s, is now also publicly supportive of a family allowance. In the middle of the 1992 presidential election, George Bush was again toying with income assistance, this time proposing a several hundred dollar per person one-time giveaway, ostensibly to spur the economy. Irrespective of the political reasons for that claim, or whether the level of proposed expenditures was high enough to have the desired effect, the notion that it would benefit the economy is important for future discourse. For that matter, Bill Clinton's proposal to invest some billions of dollars to jumpstart the economy has the same economic rudiment to get, except that instead of giving to everyone, he will confine the giveaway to contracts of one sort or another, not unlike the Great Society programs of the 1960s. During that period of U.S. history, when guaranteed income was seriously discussed, four long-term experiments were done to see what would happen if income were guaranteed. Two groups of low-income people were followed in each experiment. One was given guaranteed income with no strings attached. The other was given nothing. They would not have gotten outside the current system. The behavior of both was followed over the next decade. Much has been written about the results, naturally informed by the political bias of the writers. There are some facts, some surprising, others not. One major concern of those involved in examining the outcomes was whether income guarantees would stop people from working. The answer to that question is mixed. Mothers in two-parent families with a guaranteed income reduced their total wage work from 17 to 31%, depending on the experiment, over the group with no special treatment. In one of the experiments, single mothers reduced their total wage work by about 12 as compared with 22.7% for married mothers. In another, single mothers reduced their wage work by only 2%. In any case, the reduction was not very high at all and may represent a choice made by some women to be full-time caretakers when they had the financial opportunity. It is arguable that this behavior is socially desirable, or, at a minimum, neutral. Fathers in two-parent families, for the most part, reduce their work hours by much less than mothers, from 1% to 7%, depending on the experiment. The project director of the Seattle-Denver experiment, Robert Spiegelman, argued, quote, "There are many ways to cut work hours. Over a period of time, you can cut by taking longer to look for a job, by taking more leave without pay, by turning down overtime when offered. We find the most common way is on job turnover. People just take longer to get reemployed by stretching out the periods in which you don't work. You cut your income somewhat and substitute some leisure and some income maintenance. That's the kind of trade-off that all people make. You don't work as many hours as you physically could." Whatever the reasons, the decrease in work time of fathers was virtually negligible and not necessarily problematic. For decades, reduction of work hours has been a primary mechanism for increasing leisure, as well as spreading jobs to more people. Since the experiments had no way of measuring the effects of increased consumption brought to the communities involved because of increased disposable income, it is impossible to say whether total wage work was reduced at all. It is quite likely that any reductions in work by some resulted in increased hours put in by others as more money was spent in the communities, increasing either employment opportunities or work time for current employees. In all likelihood, productivity either increased or stayed the same. Increased dependency was not a factor. The consequence most alarming to some was an increase in the dissolution of marriages by those with income guarantees in one of the four experiments. But this could actually be a positive outcome, allowing people in unhappy marriages to leave. Women in battering relationships, for instance, may have left husbands they might otherwise have felt forced to stay with. Income was based on the number of people in the family, not marital status. People in happy marriages do not have reason to leave when they have a stable income. Increased income does increase freedom. To reject guaranteed income as a means to enforce marital vows would be to argue that families ought to be kept poor. That would be cruel and ludicrous. And the opposite argument has been made for years, that poverty and/or welfare increase the tendency for family breakup. I would reject either argument. Families break up for many reasons. Happy families, husbands, and wives who love each other in nonviolent relationships, do not. The social welfare field continues to grow at breakneck speed, whether it's social workers per se, income maintenance clerks, administrators, hotshot executives, whatever. In a reasonable world with income guarantees, there would be some automatic shrinkage of this sector. Those macro-analytic political scientists who get bent out of shape at the very thought of any diminution of the social service sector are simply off base. It doesn't matter a whit how big the sector is if the consequence of its growth is the increased misery of those it is supposed to serve. That said, there are a number of points to be made regarding those who continue service work, what their roles should be, and what a guaranteed income could mean to them also. People sometimes jump to the conclusion that I am arguing that no poor people want or need social services and all social workers are bad. Not so. I am concerned, however, about who makes the decision to access services, how they get paid for, how to eliminate fraud and abuse, and how to depoliticize the service system. It is unlikely that any income guarantees in the foreseeable future would be generous enough to allow those with no other means of income support simply to purchase the services they need as they see fit. At the same time, as the welfare state is currently structured, to the extent that there is massive funding of services, it is often for assistance people do not need or will not accept because of the inadequacy of the providers. As in the case with most economic development schemes, the problem arises from the top-down nature of the funding structures. Usually, services that are made available to people who cannot afford to pay as they go are funded by contract with the government, or through tax expenditures resulting from tax-deducted donations, often with a shove by one or another advocacy group lobbying for its own. The only sensible way to structure public services is to put them on some kind of market mechanism. There are many ways this could be accomplished. For instance, poor families could be given vouchers worth up to $3,000 to spend on services they wish to have. Let's also say that if they do not use the whole allotment annually, half the difference stays in the treasury, the other half goes to the family. For families with extraordinary difficulties, a special request process could be in place to exceed the limit on a case-by-case basis. The potential of a financial return for limiting use of the services to essentials would be one way of controlling costs and ensuring that the service hawks who fail to deliver on their promises lose their patrons. Over time, we could eliminate much of the contracting out system, reducing the guaranteed incomes of countless institutions currently on the government tit. It wouldn't be all that long before unwanted, unused, and unsatisfactory service programs melted away. If people could choose which services they wished to patronize, those most attractive to them would flourish. It wouldn't take long before appropriate services shifted from where organizations wish them to be, often where poor people are not, to where people who go to them want them to be, within some comfortable distance of home. This cannot happen when politicians and public policymakers decide which services are goods to pay for and whom they will pay. Politics and people being what they are, patronage, nepotism, and greed will outweigh merit in the spirit of democracy the way the current system dishes out service contracts. Capitalism works for those who have access to the means of consumption. Billions of dollars could be saved. If people had enough money to buy real food, the last place you'd find most of them would be at the soup kitchens and food pantries. Not only these, but literally dozens of superfluous competing bureaucracies could be wiped out. Taxes that are forfeited in the not-for-profit discard market scam, replete with champagne and caviar charged off for benevolent balls, would go a long way toward really helping people in need while eliminating waste and corruption in the current system. Those entities that no longer really depend on foundations or direct government funds for most of their income because they function largely on endowments have no excuse. They should be required to prove that 100 or so years after they were comfortably established, they are doing work of true value that is worth the price we pay and forfeited national wealth and desired by the people they ostensibly work for, poor ones. It's not enough for them to say so. Their much abused political clout would go down the drain right along with the repeated mismanagement and other nonsense we all end up paying for. Dissolve them, sell off their assets, and turn the charitable millions over to the family trust fund. If there can be said to be any political home for poor women inside a larger movement, the candidate is the women's movement. Some believe that civil rights movements are more accurately the place for welfare and other poverty issues. Whereas it is true that poverty disproportionately impacts people of color, it is also the case that AFDC and low-wage work fall vastly disproportionately on women, including white women. And historically, the civil rights movements have not targeted economic rights, certainly not for the poorest people. Clearly, a critical factor in the social equation affecting poor women is that women's work generally is not assigned any value in the gross national product, even though it has very substantial consequences for any country's economy. Unless we assign inputs to the welfare mother, she can only be seen and treated as extracting outputs from everyone else. On average, she is back in the wage labor force within 3 years, then her labor is counted, even if the stigma of prior welfare receipt never quite leaves. In a brilliant economic analysis of worldwide undervaluing of women's labor, Marilyn Waring's book, If Women Counted, reads, quote, "The public policy implications of inputting women's work into the national accounts are vast. First, per capita GDP would change markedly. A more reliable indicator of the well-being of the community would be available, because all caring services, subsistence production, and that vast range of life-enhancing work would be visible and counted. And priorities would change. Unpaid workers could make a realistic claim on the public purse as opposed to being condemned to welfare." End quote. It isn't enough to acknowledge women's work in the abstract. It must be counted. If poor women's labor were counted, these women would have to rank right up there with workaholics. That work includes the usual child-rearing responsibilities, plus keeping children from freezing to death because there is no heat, keeping them clothed because there is no money left in a welfare budget after rent is paid, hauling the laundry for blocks because there is no washing machine, thinking constantly about how to raise them, worrying about their future. In a blistering summer heat wave, the job is like working in a 24 hours a day, 7 day a week sweatshop. The failure to count unwaged labor in the GDP has had very concrete consequences for women in or out of the marketplace. The valuelessness depresses women's wage potential at almost every level of the income spectrum. Until the women's movement takes this on with the same fervor accorded ERA and other issues, no amount of federal legislation will alter the basic economic equations. We must extend the call for choice from the reproductive sphere to the productive sphere. A true struggle joined in this way would finally bridge the apparent cultural gap that exists between those women who work at home raising children and those who derive their income from waged labor, as well as across class and race lines. Consider some of the following plans being put into effect, or already underway, in some states to blame and punish women for having children. Several states have or are about to implement LearnFair. The idea is that children who don't go to school, who are on welfare, are cut out of the family's budget. If the program continues, the mother is cut. In some cases, the mother is the student. Since skipping school is not a problem exclusive to AFDC families, what's to stop the state from cutting earned income tax credits from poor families with similar problems? States are also trying to force NORPLANT on AFDC women or decrease payments to women who have more than one or two children. This is not really to save money. The vast majority of welfare mothers have only one or two children. It is an expression of moral hysteria intended to mollify an ignorant, misogynist, and racist political constituency. Some states are attempting to force unmarried women with children to get married with a plan called WEDFAIR or BRIDEFAIR. Most politicians supporting these measures claim they are not intended to increase abortion rates among poor women. They maintain that the idea is to convince women to redistribute their extra kids by putting them up for adoption. If women are convinced to do anything of the kind, they would be most likely to put the kids into foster care until they can afford to get them out. The swelling of foster care institutions may seem like a fine idea to those who make their living off of them, but is it? How different are they from the children's asylums of the 19th century? How different is this from the mass shipping of children from the inner cities to rural towns and villages thousands of miles from home, as it was done in the early part of this century? When welfare mothers attempted to resist getting social security numbers for our infants, nobody paid much attention. Today, almost any child must have a social security number. It is time to hear the alarm as well as the cries of distress of our poor sisters. When the rights of women on welfare are abridged, it is only a matter of time before the rights of others are eroded in similar ways. When the bulk of poor women are denied access to abortion by the elimination of federal funding, it wasn't long before all women were facing the potential loss of choice. As evolving Supreme Court decisions have made plain, it is time to wake up. Removing the pressures of poverty from family life would have incalculable effects well into the future. Poor people would cease to seem like an economic or spiritual drain on the nation. Lifting the shroud of humiliation from the backs of poor people would release a creative energy otherwise camouflaged. Studies show that the single most important factor in educating a child is self-esteem. How can a welfare child, ashamed of his mother and perhaps father, feel anything but degraded? There are savings in future healthcare costs for a host of ills, not the least of which is low birth weight. We would save in prisons as crime would cease to be the only way out of poverty for so many. Reduced crime also means more peace of mind for all of us. The list of poverty-related ills is so vast, it is almost impossible to imagine all the benefits eliminating it would generate. Guaranteed income would alleviate personal suffering of tens of millions and at the same time improve the quality of life for all. The skeptical should try to solve this riddle. Take a neighborhood, anywhere, like Scarsdale or Bel Air, a good neighborhood. Impose the following conditions on the residents. 1. Freeze all their assets. Take all their cars away. 2. Tell one half the neighborhood that they will have their incomes reduced by half. These are the lucky ones. 3. Tell the other half they will occasionally, randomly, and arbitrarily receive half their incomes. The rest of the time, they will receive nothing. Turned off the rolls, so to speak. 4. Besiege the families with red tape. Find and use every opportunity to tell the parents, especially the mothers, that they are inferior human beings. Actually, more like subhuman, underclass. Make sure the kids here, at least once monthly, have a politician of some stature, make them the target of everyone else's woes. 5. Change the rules several times a year. Keep the rule changes complex and quasi-secret so they can't comply. Reduce police and firefighting services. take away quality child care centers for parents who will still have jobs outside the home. 7, close some schools, fire some teachers. Among those still willing to teach there, reduce salaries. Don't bother about learning standards, just move the kids through and out. 8, create cockamamie make-work jobs and training programs for the mothers that do not help them out. Make sure they work hard and worry a lot about how their children are doing without them. 9, create a massive labyrinth through which only the best and brightest can occasionally escape. 10, send in researchers. Study the people. Make them feel like animals in a zoo. Wonder why they don't like you. Assume it's an inbred form of hostility that can only be addressed by giving you public dollars. Make sure they know about this. 11, now and then spend great sums of money on small countries, minor wars, to bail out the savings and loans in which they have nothing, whatever you can think of. Tell them there's no way you can help them. Say it's the budget deficit thing, and besides, get a job. What will happen? How long will it take for housing prices to drop, stores to close, banks to move out? How long before speculating turns into gambling? How long before an alcoholic becomes a drunk? How long before a casual suburban drug user becomes a drug seller and desperate junkie needing a fix whether or not he can pay for it? How long before theft, looting, and random violence become a way of life for many? How long before what few stores remain raise their prices sky high to make up from the many others for the actions of the few? How many more guns will be sold? What kind? How long before men who can escape without their families leave them behind? How long before a nervous breakdown becomes a full-fledged mental collapse? How long does it take a whole neighborhood to disintegrate? Any neighborhood. The conditions above are essentially those that have been imposed, on the poorest neighborhoods all over the country. Try the reverse. Take a neighborhood, anywhere, South Central LA, Watts, East New York, a bad neighborhood. Reverse the dynamic. 1. Rehabilitate dilapidated housing where it makes sense. Build new housing where reason dictates. 2. Restore welfare benefits to their previous levels, or better yet, give people without paying jobs the same benefit of the doubt according to people on Social Security and the same benefit levels. Restore the value of the minimum wage. Better yet, institute a guaranteed income. 3. Make certain the checks or other means of payment come in regularly and safely for everyone. 4. Reduce red tape to an absolute minimum. Guarantee productive choice as much as reproductive choice so that women can enter and leave the wage market as they determine. Use every means available to lift the self-esteem of parents, especially mothers. Make sure the kids hear it. 5. Put back police and firefighting services. Set up quality child care services like those produced overnight during World War II, when women's labor outside the home was needed, respected, and rewarded. 6. Improve the schools. Make it cool to attend school. Make it fun. Insist that kids who can't read can't graduate. 7. Encourage the best and brightest to stay or others to come by, creating a livable environment with opportunity for advancement. How long before small businesses pop up because the aggregate income in the community has at least doubled and people can buy basic items like food and clothing again? How long before entrepreneurs start hiring other people? How long before these events spur additional economic growth, not only within this community but outside it, as more consumption requires more production of all kinds? How long before children, formerly ashamed of their parents and background, start to be proud and wish to excel? How long before mothers, whose self-esteem has soared, begin to see options in their lives and take them? How long before men who can see a productive future return? How long before the underground economy comes above ground and the most destructive elements begin to wither away, as they are no longer the only possibilities for upward mobility? Looks tough? Well, politically speaking, it is. Practically speaking, it ain't half what it's cracked up to be. Consider the income element. Any neighborhood that has had nearly half its legal income wiped out will be in trouble quick. Clearly, some mechanism must be put into place to restore the diminished aggregate income in poor communities. Since most of these communities have high proportions of single mothers taking care of their children, merely attempting to establish a job base would not suffice. Improving the economic condition of these areas would have to include increased cash assistance in some form. Usually forgotten in discussions of economic security is the positive effect it would have on the economy. The initial outlay need not be excessive if a fund from which it will come is built up first. Over time, guaranteed income would generate jobs like no other spending program could, as necessary goods and services are produced and sold in the local markets where most people would spend it. Because aggregate consumption begets aggregate production, guaranteed income would even make some wealthy people wealthier and create new wealth. The multiplier effect throughout the economy would be felt in short order. The new jobs would have an organic market link to communities, unlike so many economic development schemes that foolishly plop money into bumbling, top-down enterprises with little to no common sense relationship to the community. Guaranteed income could also eliminate price supports and subsidies of all kinds, not just in social welfare, but in every field propped up by them. Take dairy products. Every bottle of milk that you or welfare mothers buy has a hidden tax in it that in effect guarantees an adequate income to the dairy farmer. Once again, we're paying for the income security of a politically determined group. The dairy lobby is powerful. Guaranteed income to everyone, irrespective of lobbying capacity, would eliminate the stigma of welfare. It could also begin to peel away the political power that provides support to one group at the expense of another sub rosa. A more equitable system of income distribution would be a democratizing process. Industry would change. Yes, it could also boom. It is the opposite of trickle-down theory. Call it the sprout-up theory. Call it the vision thing, if you want. Redistribution is something that this country does, that many other countries do, and few reject. It usually works to the economic benefit of both the giver and the givee. For some reason, as a nation, we upset ourselves only when we think about giving to our own poor people. Giving to older, even wealthier citizens in the form of Social Security, or to dairy farmers and price supports, is no sweat. Do we stop giving to foreign nations or U.S. seniors or young widows with small children for their own good? Do we really even question it? Not on your life. Guaranteed income may seem like an exclusively redistributive strategy, but it is also an economic growth strategy predicated on democratic values. Let's face it, one of the reasons the United States introduced the Marshall Plan to rebuild parts of Europe and its counterpart in Japan was to create markets for U.S. goods, services, and technology. For a long time, it worked for all the countries involved. In any event, a socially responsible culture does not cause economic disaster. When the Berlin Wall came down, one of the first things the West German government did was to give Deutschmarks to East Germans, who flooded into West Germany to buy things. To the casual observer, this may have seemed like a magnanimous gesture of unusual proportions. To others, it was a brilliant political moment, with virtually all the money quickly flooding right back into West Germany's economy. One thing is certain, pointing the finger at poor women is neither the answer to the riddle nor the resolution of the problem. If the mean spirit that has prevailed in this country, at least since the early 70s, regarding poor people ever passes, the relatively simple objective of guaranteeing adequate income can be realized. The fact is that the entire nation would benefit. The true peace dividend is within our grasp. We need only insist upon it with our collective political will. Cynics can chide me for being naive, but they cannot challenge the eminent reasonableness of a strategy to trust poor people, just like we trust Social Security recipients and those who report to the IRS, the honor system. A major function of a civilized society is to achieve an equitable mechanism to distribute resources to all members. In a money-based economy, guaranteed adequate income is a prerequisite to any fair distribution. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Scott Santons UBI Enterprise, and thank you to all my executive producer tier supporters on Patreon and Anchor, whose names include Giselle Huff, Haroon Mokhtasarda, Stephen Grimm, Floyd Marinescu, Andrew Stern, Zach Sargent, Larry Cohen, Bridget Flynn, Jeff Liu, Ace Bailey, Albert Wenger, Athena Washington, Dara Ward, Dylan J. Herschel, Joanna Zarak, Justin Walsh, Carrie Bosworth, Laurel Gillespie, Mark Heckam, Michael Tinker, Miles McLean, Robert Collins, Sue Kaberstad, Tom Cooper, UBI Visuals, Victor Lau, Zhao Huji, Adam Laugesen, Craig Freeberg, Dan Pagan, LMSW, Gary Turner, Heidi, Laura Palmer, Marie Janik, Michael Finney, Nellie Yiptong, Peter T. Knight, Sean Zimmermaker, Thomas S.V., Bill Tang, Raj Jawa, Fred Ader, and Sanford Redlick. If you too would like to be thanked by name at the end of each episode, head on over to my Patreon page and select the Executive Producer tier, or push the Support This Podcast button on Anchor and select the $10 level.